regrette rien, ni le bien.
Hi, this is Robert Shear with the second half of my interview with Jonathan Alter, who has written what is, up to this point, the most important biography on the remarkable life of Jimmy Carter. In part one, we discuss Carter's journey from a childhood in deepest segregated rural Georgia, a truly miserable place that I actually visited in 1960, and even then there'd been very little progress. And then his election as governor of Georgia, where he was elected with segregationist support, but quickly reversed himself. And in part one, we discussed how he went on to run for the presidency and certainly governed in Georgia as a new Democrat, heralding really what has happened in the recent Senate election. And then the second part deals with his time in office, where foreign policy loomed very large, first with the Iran hostage crisis, really a dark time for Jimmy Carter. However, his success in the Camp David negotiations of separating Egypt from one of the nations and the most important military nation in the region, threatening Israel, and with the great mystery that we end up discussing or want to discuss in this second part is the question of Afghanistan. And following the leadership of his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter got involved with supporting, maybe as a diversion from the Iran hostage crisis, supporting Islamic fanatics, including bin Laden. He didn't know bin Laden, but he was not then prominent, but there were Arab Islamic fanatics who had come to Afghanistan, all opposed to a basically secular but pro-Soviet government in Kabul, and they wanted to overthrow that government. And Zbigniew Brzezinski would later brag that they gave the Soviets their Vietnam, but they also gave the world a prominent al-Qaeda and the attack on, gave America the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. So this is part two of our podcast. Welcome. He is a centrist. In fact, is a, you know, and he is actually the person who set the model for Clinton and for the new Democratic Party and so forth. Yeah. And it's interesting because one of the famous quotes, because I've checked it out reading your book, you know, because I want to check my own memory. And there's Hamilton Jordan, who was really a principal figure in all this, and himself a complex. None of these people are simple, by the way. I'm not suggesting that. No one is simple, anyway. And you learn that if you're a thoughtful journalist. But Hamilton Jordan,
maybe Trump. Trump, huh? Except maybe.
Well, we'll end up on that. But let me just say,
as the point.
Let me stick just to this subject. And I remember questioning these people about that because I knew I had traveled with Nelson Rockefeller. I knew David, you know, I reported on these people, and I knew it wasn't some compelling group that could run everything, but I knew it was just trying to establish a stance that was comfortable to Nelson and David Rockefeller and others. So I questioned about that because I had met Brzezinski before and had interviewed him and so forth, knew him. And that's where the quote came from Hamilton Jordan, where he said, if you see Zbigniew Brzezinski or a Cy Vance in the government, I would resign. We're not going to embrace the establishment. Right, right. That was in response to my question, by the way.
Oh, what? Oh, I
yes.
That was a very
It's in the article that accompanies the Playboy interview.
The quote, and the quote's in my book, but I had forgotten that came from.
Well, next time you can give me credit on it. But the point is that the reason I was bugging them about it is I'd already written about the Commission on Critical Choices, which was Nelson. I'd written about the Trilateral Commission. And clearly, those people had, and correctly, had decided there better be a new South, and you can't, that this segregation is just a loser worldwide for multinational companies, for people who want to do business. It's crazy. And Jimmy, understood that very well. And that's the real connection. But he was a centrist, is all I'm saying.
He definitely was. I mean, I think, earlier you just made the point that he anticipated Clinton and Obama. He was the first, you know, so-called new Democrat. And, you know, he was conservative on some things like budgets. He increased the defense budget, not because he wanted to go to war, but because he thought it, you know, it was a good deterrent. But he did always put peace first. And he was this really, to my mind, compelling and sometimes peculiar mixture of left and right. And on the environment, for instance, he was very far-sighted, very much to the left.
Yeah, but let me just push you a little, because now we're getting to the heart of his presidency, and I appreciate you taking the time to stick with me on this. I think it's worth doing. I think the book is worth taking very seriously. And what happens in his presidency, there's always this mixture, which you come to grips with in this book, that this is a good man. But then why doesn't he accomplish more of the goodness? And I want to give one example, which the book is not, it does not go into, and I think my only one criticism of the book was his stab at immigration reform. And it's so important, because this is, after all, what brought Donald Trump to the presidency, his playing the anti-immigrant card. And to Carter's credit, when he came in as president, very early on, one of his first initiatives was to try, you know, this immigration issue didn't start with Trump. It's been neglected. It's been exploited by every president ever since the Chinese were used to build the railroads, or go back further. We've never dealt with immigration in a serious and moral way, and certainly not from south of the border. And Carter, the Carter case is a good example, because he had an initiative. He not only had that was going to change, he had amnesty in the works, and he picked a truly terrific person, a great, actually, civil rights person, Leonel Castillo, who I got to know, in fact, went on, covered the border when Leonel Castillo was commissioner of what used to be called Immigration and Naturalization Service. He was appointed by Carter in his first months. And he also had a very good labor secretary. And they decided they were going to deal with this problem of amnesty for undocumented people that were already here, and that they also were going to find some path to not only legality, but a more sensible border policy, to recognize this was labor that was needed and so forth. Irony of ironies, he wasn't able to get it done, and it remained for Ronald Reagan to actually pass one of the rare amnesty bills, not far enough. And it's interesting, because I stumbled while I was preparing for this interview, a Carter speech in 2017, in which he says, don't write Trump's approach off. It's not a hopeless cause, because maybe, and this was when Trump was apparently willing to accept DACA to some degree, the making legal the people who had been brought over here as young as children and so forth, and they were going to compromise if the Democrats did something about the wall. And here was Carter, I think he was 92 years. He was speaking at Emory University in Atlanta. I didn't even know this until 5 o'clock this morning when I was going over my notes and everything. And he said, hey, you know, this could be a breakthrough. This is a hard issue to deal with. And if we can make some progress on DACA, this could be a good thing. And if Trump and Pelosi and Schumer could get together, but that was an example to me of Carter had the right intentions, but he couldn't deliver on it.
Well, let me just try to explain a couple of things. So when Jimmy Carter became president, he tackled every issue. He didn't just pick, you know, three or four and say, these are my priorities. He sent a message to Congress. That was the form that he used, a letter to Congress outlining what the right policy solution would be on literally scores of issues, almost all of them important. Now, immigration was not at an acute place at that time. And even though I did interview Ray Marshall, his labor secretary, who's still around, and we talked a little bit about their immigration initiative. It didn't make the cut for my book because it was killed on Capitol Hill, like so many of his other initiatives. And that's because the system that we had then in Congress was that they called them the old bulls, the committee chairs, all men at that time, the committee chairmen in both the House and the Senate, controlled by Democrats, but they had these fiefdoms. And that bill did not make the cut for them for reasons that, you know, had to do with the politics of Capitol Hill. So I had to focus on initiatives that either passed or came close to passing and where there was a story attached. And there were so many of them, and there was so much more that went through. I mean, what really eventually struck me was that this idea, oh, Carter, he didn't get his program through. That is completely wrong. He got huge chunks of legislation through in many, many different areas. But there were some areas, you know, consumer reform, labor law reform, immigration, parts of his energy policy, parts of his stimulus program, where he was defeated. And then on, you know, water projects, most famously, when he wanted to cut these boondoggle water projects, and that infuriated Capitol Hill. And that poisoned the well, actually, on some other issues. But he got met in 4 years, in part because he had a Democratic Congress for 4 years, and Obama and Clinton just had a Democratic Congress for 2 years, even though they were in office for 8 years. In 4 years, Carter got more legislation through than either Barack Obama or Bill Clinton. Not to mention,
the book makes a good case for that, yeah. And I agree with it. And you can throw in environmental concerns and solar. There are a lot of things, and I don't think it was a failed presidency in that sense. I just bring it up because immigration is an issue that not a single administration has ever dealt with in a moral and consistent way. Not one in the course of American history, whether it was the Chinese that were exploited or anyone else, and certainly not for people from Mexico and from Central America.
How about the bipartisan bill that Reagan signed in 1986? That did provide some amnesty.
Yeah, there is some amnesty. I mean, Reagan got some.
Was that a bad bill? Was that a bad bill? I think that was a pretty good bill. The difference was that Reagan, as it was like an only Nixon could go to China thing, he and Alan Simpson and a guy named Mazzoli on the House side, Congressman Mazzoli, they were able to get a compromise that Carter couldn't get because of the politics of immigration. He was a Democrat, and you know, the Republicans were all opposing him, and a lot of conservative Democrats were opposing him. But Carter's immigration initiative, it really did not make it very far.
And there was no urgency. There was a lot of urgency because the actual number of people coming across the border, those numbers were increasing dramatically. I happened to cover this for the LA Times at that time. I went with Leonel Castillo to the border, and the brutality was there, the death of people crossing the desert, and the numbers, the alarm of racists and hypocrites on the other side about the these illegal aliens crossing over. This all built up to, you know, California even having some of the worst legislation, Prop 187, the vote is passing in the supposedly enlightened state, right, saying that undocumented, you know, kids couldn't even go to school. I mean, so this happened, right, under a moderate Republican, Pete Wilson, and so forth. But right, the point I'm making is Jimmy Carter did the right thing. He picked a very good person, Leonel Castillo, to be head of immigration. He had a great labor secretary. They made very strong statements. But the fact of the matter is, the media didn't support it. Most politicians didn't want to touch it. That's really the issue. Right. That's not a condemnation of Carter. It's a condemnation of the system.
So let me. And so it's not. Let me give you a little example of this. So Carter makes a state visit to Mexico, and he has this guy, Pat Lucey, who's the former governor of Wisconsin, as his ambassador, who ended up...
This is Montezuma's revenge. Huh?
Yeah. But so Pat Lucey, you know, he's got a disloyal ambassador who ends up supporting Ted Kennedy in 1980 and then running as John Anderson's running mate in the fall. That's how much he disliked Carter. But he goes to Mexico and he tries to straighten it out a little bit, make a little bit of progress on the immigration issue and some other bilateral issues in this state visit. He's insulted by the president of Mexico. And then he does something kind of dumb, which is in some ways typical of Jimmy Carter, in that he's, you know, we have this expression TMI, too much information, right? And Carter always, he took transparency to a fault. So for instance, later he got hemorrhoids and he had to miss a couple of days' work, really painful hemorrhoids. And they said, you know, make an excuse about why you're not showing up for work. And he said, if I do that, you know, foreign capitals, they won't know what to believe. And I'm not going to lie. I don't lie. I promise I wasn't going to lie. He tells the press office, put out that he has hemorrhoids. So they do this, you know. And of course, he's ridiculed for this. And Sam Donaldson yells across the driveway at the White House to Jerry Rafshoon, one of Carter's aides, Jerry, how's the president's asshole today? You know, and he's completely ridiculed. So Mexico is another example of this. He gets up and he makes a toast when he's in Mexico City, and he's remembering a trip that he had taken in 1965 with his family to Mexico. And it was actually a very memorable trip because, when he got back, he found that his neighbors in Plains were boycotting his business because they had been told by the local John Birch Society that he was really at a Marxist training camp with his family, and they were all training to be Marxists. And actually, that was a lie, a right-wing lie. They had gone to Mexico. When they went to Mexico in 1965, they got what was called then Montezuma's revenge. They got diarrhea when they went to Mexico. So in 1978, when he is on his state visit to Mexico, when he is giving a speech, he makes a little joke about how the last time he was there, they got Montezuma's revenge. The press corps reports only on this. The whole visit is overshadowed by this Montezuma's revenge comment. It's the only thing anybody remembers. And his efforts to, you know, fix immigration policy, other agricultural, bilateral issues, out the window.
Another example of how maybe Donald Trump is sometimes right when he criticizes the media, but let's not go there.
Wait a minute. I got to interrupt you there, okay? Because this is something that makes me crazy, is that there's a big difference between legitimate criticism of the media for not covering substance and calling the media, as Mao, Stalin, and Hitler did, the enemy of the people. So yeah. I will not concede even a fraction of an inch of Trump's press critique being right.
Yeah, well, I think Nixon felt they were the enemy of the people. And I'm not going to say Jimmy Carter felt that way, but the fact of the matter is, if these issues matter, the media has to be serious. And I just want to, because we're going to run out of time, but talking about his presidency, I want to agree with something in your book. I mean, the main thesis of your book is that Jimmy Carter was not a cartoon figure, and he was not some yokel. He was very sophisticated and very smart. And he brought that to foreign policy. He brought that to many issues, environment and what have you. But here, his seriousness was actually used against him. And it continues into his post-presidency life. So we're going to run out of time here, but I don't want to end this without picking up a couple of subjects that sort of illustrate that and the complexity of it all. One is his position on Israel, and that where he's shown a lot of courage, I think, in trying, and you're correct, one of the big achievements of his presidency is that he brought Begin, Menachem Begin, and Anwar Sadat together. The whole process at Camp David that would have fallen apart, he was really more successful maybe than any other president trying to make inroads. That has not was not sustained. The Palestinians are still kept in a situation of apartheid. But nonetheless, your book in great detail goes into Jimmy Carter's effectiveness in diplomacy on that issue. And he took a lot of abuse for it. I remember even when he was president, I remember Lou Wasserman, I happened to be doing an interview with him for a story about Jewish life in L.A., and he was being attacked all over L.A. because he still supported Carter, even though Carter seemed to be not as supportive of Israel as some people would have liked. And it continued. We haven't talked about his time after being president, but he certainly has consistently pursued this concern about peace and for the Israelis, but for the Palestinians as well. So maybe we should talk about a little bit of that. And then I want to end with a little discussion about Afghanistan. Okay.
Okay. So on Israel, you know, you say I have a lot of detail about Camp David. It was a nail biter, you know, and both Begin and Sadat threatened to leave over and over again. It's an amazing chapter in American history. The first time an American president, the only time an American president actually personally negotiated what is the most durable peace treaty since World War II. But people didn't know at the time that it would hold. And in fact, it fell apart, and Carter, 6 months after Camp David, had to go to the region, put the whole thing back together with chewing gum and baling wire and masking tape. But there hasn't been a shot fired in anger between Israel and Egypt in all the years since, in the 42 years since. And why is this so significant? Well, I'm Jewish, and when I was growing up, I was always told, rightly, that Israel is in danger of being driven into the sea. By who? There was only one army in the Middle East that could drive Israel into the sea. That was the Egyptian army that was an existential threat against Israel. So what Carter did by taking the Egyptian army off the table as a threat to Israel made him the greatest president for the security of the state of Israel since Harry Truman and the founding of Israel. And this is something that when you mention this is a huge shock to Jews. They go, what? Come on. Carter, he's pro-Palestinian. How could he be? And I said, I didn't say he was the greatest president rhetorically for Israel. He criticizes Israel all the time, but he was the greatest president for the security of Israel. So if you believe that deeds are more important than words, as I do most of the time, then you have to give Jimmy Carter huge props on that, even though he's the only Democratic president in modern history who got less than 50% of the Jewish vote. And to this day, there are many Jews who turn up their nose when they hear about Jimmy Carter. And they have some reason to be critical of him, given some of what he's done since he left office in the Middle East, where he has actually not been notably successful. And I think that his animus toward Israel has been kind of clouding his ability to be a neutral broker there. But as a former president, even though he tried a lot, there's not really very much he got done there. And his real achievements were in nearly eradicating guinea worm disease in Africa and preventing wars in Haiti and North Korea. And he really has not, he got one ceasefire and he was right at a certain point to be an intermediary to Hamas when the U.S. government could not. And I defend him on that. You know, it's easy to meet with friends. It's hard to meet with enemies. That's what diplomacy is about. So I'm not critical of him for meeting with Hamas. But I think some of his statements have been a bit intemperate. And I explore in the book how the failure to have a comprehensive peace that is the, he believes is the great work, unfinished work of his life. It eventually kind of embittered Jimmy Carter some on the Middle East. So again, it's a very complex, and I think
it's complex in some ways, but you know, thinking of a political actor, it's really shows great courage. I mean, Jimmy Carter has asserted that the Palestinians are people, and a people, actually. He still supports the two-state solution. And you know, as a human rights person, which we haven't talked about, you know, Habitat for Humanity is building houses, is concerned about poverty and everything else, which is very exemplary. But I think as a courageous stance, because everybody knows that criticism of Israel is a third rail of American, one of the third rails of American politics. And here you have, it's an embarrassment in a way for people who have a simplistic view of Israel's security, because right now the president in American history who most resolutely supported an aggressive view of Israel's interests, as represented by Netanyahu, has been Donald Trump. Donald Trump is very popular. Put the controversy right out.
Terrible president for Israel, because what he did was he politicized American Jewish feelings about Israel, and he turned it into a partisan issue, which is a terrible, terrible thing for Israel. So just
because I understand and I agree with
the embassy doesn't mean he was good for Israel. And also by kind of denigrating the rights of the Palestinians, he didn't.
I agree.
But I think Carter, I mean, I agree with you that, you know, actually starting when he was president and when he mentioned Palestinians at a town meeting and their legitimate rights at a town meeting shortly after he became president, there was courage there in some ways, even though he couldn't fully change the policy for a lot of reasons. And he has been pretty courageous since. He was a bit too credulous about the assurances of Yasser Arafat. He threw in with him a little much, and bringing him to planes and all that, you know, I don't know how that really necessarily hit the ball, but there. So you know, it has become almost an obsession for him. And the reason that I focus so much on Camp David is that that is a truly great achievement, and the rest of it is mostly rhetorical, and one can, you know, like it, not like it, whatever. But Camp David stands as actually a monumental achievement, even though the portion of it that related to Palestinian autonomy, although it set up future, what became known as the peace process, it wasn't successful at the time. It was the handing over of the Sinai and peace with Egypt, which, you know, was the major accomplishment. And I think, you know, it's been so long that people just forget what a big deal peace with Egypt is. So Trump has, you know, he has a deal between, you know, one of the Gulf states in Israel, right? A pimple compared to Camp David.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
Look, we have to agree to disagree here, and we can do another podcast on Israel and Palestine. But
on Palestine, Bob. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just talking about in terms of his what are his contributions? You know, term.
I'm just talking about his, for people who criticize Carter as flip-flopping and not having, you know, which I've done on the immigration issue just in this show. But I must say, you know, if you compare, because if the standard is, do you stick to a line that, say, AIPAC would be happy with? Because, you know, we had this issue even in the Georgia Senate race where, you know, some candidate is winning candidate, Democrat, minister, is criticized for not having been sufficiently supportive of the Netanyahu government. Then he has to be drink the Kool-Aid and yes, okay, I'm against the boycott and so forth. I'm just saying in Carter's case, he clearly has shown both as president and after that he could tackle a complex, tough issue. And I agree with you. I think he brought greater security to Israel than what Trump has done, which I think will ultimately not help security. But Trump has certainly been a patsy for hardline supporters of Israel.
But one thing, you mentioned the boycott. So Carter is adamantly against boycott.
I understand.
Israel. When the Arab states, when he was president, when they were boycotting Israel, he fought really hard against that. And he thinks BDS is a terrible idea. So I just want to make that
Look, so I think it's good to read your book because you lay out these arguments very clearly. So let me end because we're going to be the longest podcast I've done, but I think it's worth it. I think the book is really interesting and important. I do want to deal with one final thing because at the end, Carter, we haven't talked at all about the hostage crisis, but I think that's been examined ad nauseum. I mean, it's gone over and over and over and the lot's done. I'd like to talk, just end with talking about Afghanistan, which is related in a way. And one of the things that happened in my Playboy interview, which you do, you have a chapter on the lust in the heart thing, but it's interesting. And you mentioned Sam Donaldson who had interviewed me. The story broke when I was on the airplane when Carter was campaigning and he was going to meet you. I think in the book you say it was Houston. I think it was Dallas, but I may be wrong. But I remember what I thought was going to be controversial in that Playboy interview was not the lust in the heart, which I thought was a very sensible explanation, almost a Sunday school explanation of that we all have capacity for evil in us, we have to struggle, et cetera, et cetera. It was nothing new about that. What I thought was interesting was when I asked him, because he was quite hawkish, as an incoming president, would you give us another Vietnam? After all, the Democrats have been very hawkish on foreign policy and have brought on, George W. Bush tried to rival them, but they certainly were quite aggressive. And Vietnam was in mind at the time when he was running. And he gave a very strong answer that I thought was going to be the center of controversy. He said, I would never lie the way Lyndon Johnson did. I would not do a Vietnam because I would not lie to the American people. And as you mentioned in the book, Lady Bird Johnson left the airport where she was supposed to be greeting him when our plane landed. And so this was the first thing Sam Donaldson was asking me about. And then suddenly people were reading further. Oh, wait a minute, there's this lust thing. And that took over. But from a point of view of our national security, this lying about foreign policy is far more significant. And I think Afghanistan is an interesting part of the story because what happened was, and your book does discuss it, there's a question about when the Russians invaded Afghanistan. Is that the case that we were just sort of shocked and innocent, or Gates has said in his book, and that he came out in 96, Shadow. I'm jumping through this very quickly so we don't go too long on time. But there's a whole nother backstory of the Carter administration having weighed in to support the Mujahideen who were opposed to the secular government in Kabul. And we don't want to get lost in the weeds on this. But certainly that backstory was never told, and it involved some deception or lying, normally passes under the guise of diplomacy. That, in fact, you know, actually, what Zbigniew Brzezinski said was he thought it was a great success because he wanted to lure the Russians into their own Vietnam, which would indicate a great deal of cynicism. And the people that we ended up backing at that time ended up being Al-Qaeda, some of them, and bin Laden was there at that time, and they ended up attacking, blowing up the World Trade Center. And and Brzezinski was actually quoted, this is before 9/11, by Nouvelle Observatoire, saying, what's the big deal? We won the Cold War, and so you have a bunch of riled up Muslims. Part of the whole war on terror.
Yeah. So I interviewed Brzezinski not too long before he died for the book, and I asked him about all of this, and he basically doubled down on that interview from before 9/11. Where I guess I would disagree is jumping to the conclusion that Carter's public negative reaction to the Soviet invasion was a lie and that he actually welcomed it so that they could have their own Vietnam. That's not really what was happening. And, you know, I was in the minutes of the newly declassified National Security Council discussions after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan at Christmas time, 1979. And that was not what was happening. So it's true that the previous summer, Carter had signed off at Brzezinski's recommendation on support for the Mujahideen. And that afterward, Brzezinski said, you know, it's nice that we helped create a Soviet Vietnam that helped win the Cold War. But it was just kind of a normal and actually quite defensible covert operation against the Soviet-backed regime that was in power at that time in Kabul. So by the following winter of 1979-80, they actually believed that it was a serious strategic setback to the United States that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Now, you can debate whether it really was, like Ted Kennedy didn't think it really was. You could say that Carter overreacted by boycotting the Olympics and the grain embargo, which was not just ineffective, but terribly harmful to this day to Democrats in the Farm Belt, where you can find older farmers who still say it all went bad when Carter imposed that grain embargo. That's when I became a Republican. You can still hear that now. So, you know, you can argue about the policy that Carter undertook afterward, but I don't think the whole thing was a ruse. I don't think that bears scrutiny. I'm not sure I would have said that before I saw the minutes of these NSC meetings, but now I think Carter's reaction was pretty sincere. Even if the Carter doctrine may have been, you know, in the light of history, unnecessary. But you got to remember, at that time, you know, the Carter doctrine was like, don't mess with us in the Persian Gulf because of oil. And you can go, well, what, you know, that's what the Gulf War in 1991 was about. It was about oil. Yes, that's true. But they had us over a barrel. Like, now that we're basically energy independent, it's easy for us to say, why would we have, you know, gone up to the edge of war in the Persian Gulf over oil? Well, it's because we were entirely dependent on it, and our country's economy was entirely dependent on it. So those were actually legitimate strategic interests that the United States had at that time.
Okay, and as I say, we don't have time to really get into the weeds on this, but I do want to say, because we have it, now let's mention the Iran hostage thing. This was, but you know, why, like, without the pandemic, probably Trump would have a second term. That's no excuse for him. But without the Iran hostage crisis and the Olympic boycott, which in your book you say ended up not being popular. But, you know, Jimmy Carter would have had a second term. You know, events overwhelmed him. And they were not of his making. He didn't create the hostage crisis and didn't do anything wrong. But I actually interviewed Bob Dole, who was at that point preparing a run against Carter. And that was, I did interviewed him in the Los Angeles Times, January 1980. And he said he thought Afghanistan, and Bob Dole certainly was not some pacifist. He said, quote, "I see it as a diversion from the Iran thing. The hype is running out. There's not much more mileage in Iran unless the hostages are freed. So while they're trying to figure out some way to pull that off, you'd better focus on some other explosive thing like Afghanistan." And then Bob Dole added, you know, he said, I wonder about the word invasion. I guess it's an invasion, but they've had the country for 20 months. Suddenly it's like it just happened overnight, and this great friend of the West has been taken over by the Soviets. And so I'm saying it's Bob Dole and others who thought the Afghan thing was done for political advantage. Now, we can't settle that, but I'm just saying there was a gap between Carter's absolute sincere certainty when he told me I would never lie, and whether you agree with me or not that this was a lie, it certainly was not the whole truth about what was happening.
There's a couple of things on this. First of all, there was some political calculation in his response in Afghanistan for the reasons that Dole was right about that, you know, the hostages had been seized the previous November. There was this rally around the flag thing after they were seized that really helped Carter. And, you know, they were seized the same day Ted Kennedy gave this disastrous interview to Roger Mudd. And Kennedy dropped about 30 points in the polls in the period after the hostages were seized. But then, you know, November, they're not out. December, they're not out. People are starting to get impatient. And but the timing of that, they didn't really get impatient until later. And so Carter was going to win the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary, even if he had not responded strongly to the invasion of Afghanistan. So I don't think that was entirely a political move, although it did contribute to this image of strength that was helping Carter a lot politically. So there is a grain of truth to what Dole says, but Dole and everybody else voted for the Olympic boycott, for the grain embargo. You know, so in that sense, he was just trying to figure out something to criticize Carter on. Having said that, you know, Carter at that time was I think he had kind of blown his initial response to the Iranian Revolution a year earlier, and he mishandled his relationship with Ted Kennedy. So there were a lot of things that were going on at that time. But I don't think, and I discussed with Carter whether he overreacted to the invasion of Afghanistan. And he was pretty straightforward about it. He goes, look, I mean, this was the first time outside of Europe, you know, that the Soviets had ever invaded another country. I mean, it had been at Czechoslovakia in 1968, Hungary in 1956, and Carter was, there was never any plans for them to intervene militarily. So, you know, he wasn't going to react the way maybe a Republican president would have, you know, including Bob Dole. If the Soviets had invaded another country on Bob Dole's watch, I think in his party, he would have had to respond more strongly than Carter did. But but his main point was just, and this is the guy who put solar panels on the White House roof, wanted to get us off foreign oil. But, you know, he did have to worry about whether the Soviet Union could be in a position, they would have to go through Iran, but things were very unstable there, to seize control of the Persian Gulf. And that's something, if you're president, you have to think about that. You can't just say after the fact, oh, that was never a problem. They were never going to do that, you know. They might have. Now, I don't want to convey, though, that I think that he handled all of this brilliantly. What he handled even the hugely important historic achievements like the human rights policy, which we haven't talked about, which set for the first time in human history, a major power set a standard about how other governments should treat their own people. And this will be Professor Carl Deutsch of Harvard, an international relations professor, told Carter, who was despondent or at least a little depressed after he lost the presidency. He said, 1,000 years from now, people are going to be talking about your presidency because of the human rights policy and what this did. And Václav Havel and other people, same thing. But that was my point, Bob, is that was a hypocritical policy. You know, they were supporting Marcos. They were supporting the Shah of Iran for a long time. In the same way that other policies, you can criticize dimensions of them. But what you have to look at when you're looking at one of these presidents in the longer view of history is, what does it add up to, you know? And in that sense, Carter's foreign policy, I think, was collectively, and we haven't even talked about preventing a war in Central America by turning over the Panama Canal to the Panamanians, which was a hugely unpopular thing for Carter to do. If you look at it in the totality, his foreign policy, despite the hostages taking 444 days before they came home, despite, you know, criticism of him for Afghanistan or the way he responded to the Iranian Revolution, in total, it was an unheralded success. And I would argue a big success, including normalization of relations with China, which has yielded, you know, for all the problems we have in that bilateral relationship, it has yielded a generation of peace between now that, you know, the two reigning powers in the world. So, and helped lead to bringing hundreds of millions of Chinese peasants out of poverty. You know, which is a huge contribution. So, you know, in total, this is a foreign policy which it's actually shocking that it hasn't been more examined by historians.
Yeah, I think that your book makes a very strong case that Jimmy Carter was very much underestimated president. What I'm suggesting is that it also illustrates how little we often know, and that journalism, you know, actually reading your book, I didn't feel as good about journalism as I would like to, because there's a trivialization. And again, I don't want to belabor the Afghan thing. People can research it all they want. That had a big human rights component to it. And the whole idea was somehow, once again, we're on the side of freedom. Well, in what sense? The government in Kabul, that, yes, was a communist government of some kind in Kabul, but, you know, women had a degree of freedom that they have certainly not had since. It was a secular government. The evidence is pretty clear that the Russians didn't want to get involved, that they knew it was a minefield. And Zbigniew Brzezinski is probably accurate in that he was successful in luring them into something. It was a mess. But the fact is, we weighed in on the side of the people who have turned out to be brutal oppressors. That's of true. Women. And again, of human rights, we did. We gave them aid 6 months before. That evidence is quite clear. And all I'm trying to indicate, maybe it's a good point on which to close, and I'll give you the last word, is that Jimmy Carter stood for a certain moral clarity based in a very good view of, I guess, Judeo-Christian ethics and so forth. And he came out with that very simple, clear statement, we would not have a Vietnam because I would not lie. Well, as David Halberstam pointed out in his book, you know, The Best and the Brightest, Vietnam's lies were given to us by the best and the brightest, by the people who came through the meritocracy.
Right.
And in a sense, that's the trap that any that Jimmy Carter, he's not the first president, fell into on some issues. That's all I'm indicating. Mm-hmm. That is a flawed process.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree with that. And you know, you could argue that support for the Mujahideen, which led to the Taliban, you know, which led to 9/11. So history is a fabric. If you pull a thread, you find these connections. And the Carter administration, like everybody in Washington, they were pretty ignorant about Islam. They somebody heard Walter Mondale say in the hall, "What's an Ayatollah?" You know, most people, they couldn't tell the difference between Shiite and Sunni if their life depended on it in Washington. So there was a real ignorance there that contributed to some policy missteps. But I think just what happened with the press, and I completely agree with you that my view of the press in this period anyway changed after I researched this book, because, you know, Carter was elected because of Watergate. He never would have been president, an obscure governor, if it hadn't been for Watergate. But he was also arguably defeated because of Watergate. As Jody Powell said, you know, not only did we not get a honeymoon, we didn't get a one-night stand. And the press was easy prey to William Safire, the very conservative New York Times columnist. He had worked for Nixon, and he wanted to show that Carter was just a liar and a crook like Nixon. And so he put gate on every little flap, anything that happened in the Carter administration, he'd put the suffix gate on it. And the goal was to make it seem like Jimmy Carter was just like all the rest of them. But he wasn't. He was flawed. He was politically inept in many ways. He exaggerated. Maybe, you know, if he used the Washington Post, you know, four Pinocchios, five Pinocchios, maybe there'd be a one Pinocchio in there once in a while. But he didn't tell like five Pinocchio whoppers. He just didn't. And you know, the press was conditioned to want to not just hold him accountable, which is our job, but to kind of rip him a new one, which is not really our job. And you know, I agree with you that my view of what we do changed a little bit there. But having said that, you know, the economy was in such bad shape. His impotence in getting the hostages back was so out front. His mishandling of his relationship with Ted Kennedy led to a disunified Democratic Party, that he had all these other things that were going against him in 1980. But we have to, and I guess this is the thought that I'd like to leave people with, you know, we are both journalists and historians, you and I, Bob, but journalism, it's a little bit of a different function than when you write history. And when you put on the historian's hat, you have to sort through and judge these guys, not just by, you know, how popular they were in their own day, how successful they were in their own day, which is what journalists do, you know, who's up and who's down. That's what Washington reporters do a hell of a lot of the time. Not just judging by the optics, by the fact that his optics were bad and Reagan was a much better communicator, but judge them by how did they change the world? How did those policies play out years later? I mean, you know, Trump would never have been impeached if it wasn't for Carter, because the Ethics in Government Act of 1978 protected whistleblowers for the first time, right? And there are many, many other examples of the downstream effects of Carter's policies, a human rights policy. You know, most countries in Latin America in the years after Carter left office moved from autocracies to democracies. That was very connected to that human rights policy. So the historian's job is a little different. It's to try to connect some of these dots and look at how they changed the country and the world.
Yeah, and we're going to end this right now. I've been promising that for an hour, but I think it's worth listening to. But anyway, the book is definitely worth reading. His very best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. I've been talking to Jonathan Alter, and I want to endorse what you just said. First of all, whether we like it or not, we're going to be controlled by history to a considerable degree, so we better have a clear understanding of it. And my own complicated article that I ran in Playboy along with the interview, I struggled with this question and concluded, really, I couldn't definitively answer the question. But then I ended with a little story about how they were trying to get Carter, the thing you referred to, one of his speeches, and he was reading it to them, and up in his hotel room, and they wanted him to cut an attack on the establishment, you know. And he said, no, I have a very strong visceral feeling about that, and I want to use it. And it was, you know, an echo of his, I don't know, populism, but it was his sincerity. And then I wrote, just to show you, I said, after all these months, after all the ambiguity and the packaging and the rewritten history, my visceral feeling, he said he had a visceral feeling about that. I want to use it. And then I wrote, after all these months, after all the ambiguity and the packaging and the rewritten history, my visceral feeling is that Jimmy Carter has those visceral feelings. And so
that's a good line.
I want to say, having read your book, and as I say, it's worth the 680 pages, because it leaves one with a sense that we have in Jimmy Carter someone we have underestimated as to his contribution, as to his earnestness, let me use that word. We also have underestimated the importance of his religious concerns, his struggle with ideas in the best sense of a struggle with religious, within oneself about these ideas. And I think your book does, it's the best book to read about Jimmy Carter and to read about a whole period of American history. So let me just recommend that. His very best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. And it's been an incredible life. Hopefully it goes on a bit longer, but at least we now have in your book a very interesting, important record. Let me thank Christopher Ho at KCRW-FM for putting these shows up, Natasha Hakimi for writing the introduction, Lucy Berbio for doing the transcription, which this time is going to be quite a bit of work, but again, will help establish the historical record. And I want to thank the JWK Foundation, which gives us some funding to do this in memory of a really terrific writer, Gene Stein, who I know would have found this discussion very interesting. So for another one, see you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence. C'est payé, balayé, oublié. Je me fous du passé avec mes souvenirs. J'ai allumé le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs. Je n'ai plus besoin d'eux. Balayer les amours avec leur trémolo, balayer pour toujours.